Hello, and welcome to the Preview Spotlight Interviews on the Comic Page Podcast. My name is John Mayer.
And I'm Bob Brutal. In this episode, we'll be talking with creators about upcoming projects available in the current month's previews catalog. We got some really interesting interviews for this month. Got a hold of several different creators, and we're going to be putting these up in previews order, kind of strung together after this introduction. We have the Pax Romana trade paperback. We talked to the writer and artist, Jonathan Hickman, for that. That's on page 147 of the previews catalog. We have Dynamo 5 number 0, and we talked to Jay Ferber for that one. That's on page 150 of the previews catalog. And then we jump forward to Boom Studios, where we're talking about Hexed number 2. We have the writer of Hexed, Michael Nelson. Again, page 224 of your previews catalog. And then page 298 of the previews catalog, we have a very large original graphic novel called The Outer Spacemen that's based on a toy line from the 1960s. Actually, 1967, I believe, but is something that should appeal to anyone who's a fan of retro 50s, 60s sci-fi, even if you don't remember the toy line itself. And we are talking with the writer, Eric Hayes, and the owner of the license for that, Gary Schaefer. Again, page 298 of the previews catalog. And then finally, from Radical Comics, we have another wonderful entry from them, a Shrapnel number 1, where we've got the writers or visionaries behind Shrapnel, Mark Long and Nick Sagan. We're going to talk about that sci-fi epic that's going to be coming out from Radical Comics. Again, that's on page 301. Of the previews catalog. So we can dive into the interviews now, but we had a lot of fun talking to a lot of these wonderful creators. And as we always say, just harp into it, you know, any of these things that appeal to you at all, make sure you go into your shops and ask them to order these for you. With that, let's go to the interviews. We have with us now Jonathan Hickman, who is the creator of Pax Romana, which has been out in single-issue form. At least the first three issues, I believe, have been out so far. And the trade paperback, collecting issue number 1 through 4, is going to be out in January. So that means it's in the November previews catalog and available to be ordered now. You might also know Jonathan from his work on such other series as Nightly News, Red Mass for Mars, Transhuman, and others. I think you did a pilot season book called The Core also. And let's talk about Pax Romana. Tell us about the story, Jonathan.
Well, Pax Romana is one of those alternative future history kind of things. And in this, we start off in the future where monotheism is on the wane in the East and the West. And because of population shifts, Islam is overrunning Western Europe. And in one of many Vatican-funded scientific research facilities, which they actually do now, they discover time travel, and so the Pope and the Council of Cardinals have a decision to make and what to do with this discovery, and they choose to send an army back in time to Constantine's Roman Empire, who's the first Christian emperor of Rome, and they're going to remake the world. And so they do that, and things go wrong.
As they normally do, or else we don't have much of a story, huh?
That's right.
So tell us a little bit, I think, you know, so that's kind of a good hook for the story, and we certainly don't want to give away, you know, any kind of spoilers about what all's going into the story. But how about if we move a little bit into the style that you use, because you use kind of a similar stylistic way of telling this story and a lot of your other stories, well, for instance, like Nightly News and Red Mass for Mars. You're doing the art as well as the story in these books, right?
Yeah. Pax Romana, I did everything. And it's kind of with the Nightly News, I was trying to really making a concentrated effort to marry graphic design and regular comic book narrative storytelling. And you know, the Nightly News is more that way. The Pax Romana is a little bit more straightforward comic booky kind of thing. But there's a lot of information in there. I use a lot of different, there are some maps and, you know, timelines and purely narrative pages and other devices that I use. But it's, you know, it's an interesting book. I'm always trying new and different things. I'm trying new ways to tell stories, and this was yet another one.
Back on the story side, what kind of prompted you to do a kind of religious take on time travel, with them kind of, you know, going back to, you know, set things the way they think it ought to be or whatever versus the way it was turning out?
Well, I think the Pax Romana is more of a sociology experiment than a religious one. It's just that's the patina that kind of permeates the whole story. But, and, you know, it's obvious further it goes along, the more progressively it gets away from that. But I think that there's certainly something to this idea that we, you know, we live in a society that is, you know, kind of caught in a conflict between what is scientifically important and what is sociologically, you know, important. And I think that that's a push and pull that is ripe for narrative. And I don't, you know, I guess some people don't want to tell that kind of story. I think it's a pretty good time to do that.
No, I would agree with that, certainly.
And I think that you have a good niche that you're filling here, because certainly your books stand out from, I would say, run-of-the-mill type of books. I mean, there's a certain look and feel here that's, you know, even though it's this one you say is a little more comic booky, it doesn't look like your standard book when you pick it up.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, yes, there's something to that. It moves back away from my, you know, eventual long-term goal of doing stuff that is purely, I mean, it's half and half graphic design and comic book narrative. But, I mean, yeah, it looks different. I want it to look different. The coloring is I use a different palette than most comics in the coloring. And, I mean, that holds true in other books that I've done, like Red Mass and certainly in Nightly News. But, you know, look, I don't think that there's, just from a business and professional perspective, I don't think that it makes a lot of sense to walk in the same fashion or in the same line or even in the same direction that everybody else is doing. It just doesn't seem to me to be, seems to me to be professional suicide. Right?
Yeah, I can see that.
I agree, because, you know, having something that stands out from the mass of other books, you know, I think it's greatly to your credit that you can say, you know, out of the, you know, literally hundreds, if not, you know, 1,000 different comic books that are in any given previews catalog, there's a certain distinctiveness to one of your books. And I think someone can pick that up. And, you know, like with anything that's artistic, people are either going to like it or they're not going to like it. You know, people give it a try, though. And if they like it, it's since it is very distinctive, you'll be able to find, you know, be able to pick it out when there's more.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I feel pretty, all I ask of anyone is to give one issue of one of my books a try. And if they like that, I feel like I usually have them, you know, as far as a pretty dedicated reader. But, you know, I mean, I think we live in something of a golden age of comic book writers, and I certainly think that the art is not far behind. You just got to put out excellent product if you're going to be any good or get any, you know, have any commercial success, I guess. I mean, critical success really is wonderful, and I've had some of that, but, you know, that's not a, well, that doesn't pay the mortgage, does it?
Yeah.
I would actually go a step further than that. I think while it is a definite, you know, high watermark for comics right now, we've got such great stuff coming out that for anyone to really, you know, stand out, not only does your work have to be better than the rest, it's got to be excellent, but it's also got to be somewhat unique, because, you know, we've got tons of really strong superhero comics, you know, out there right now with what Brubaker's doing on Cap, Geoff Johns over at DC, and, you know, Bendis over at Marvel and stuff, that having a unique story premise like you've got, having a distinct visual style and a approach to the storytelling that you've got, as well as just the quality, I mean, that's a winning combination there. So I think that was a smart move on your part.
Thank you. Got to cut through the noise somehow, you know?
So tell us a little bit about whatever research that you did for this one. You know, you have the Vatican science. You're obviously, you have the time travel aspect, you know, what did you do, if anything, to make it as historically accurate, you know, at least at its core, before you start doing the divergent timeline thing?
Well, I mean, I'm a pretty big research guy. I do all of that stuff that is required, and I probably go way beyond that. I think it makes it so much easier, right, when you know what you're talking about when it comes to this kind of stuff, historical fiction or science fiction or you know, something like the Nightly News, where you're trying to, I don't know, tell a story from so many different perspectives and so many different viewpoints. You know, you have to know what you're talking about for it to have any credibility. You know, so, it, you know, the history stuff's pretty easy, and the history of the church stuff is pretty easy. The science stuff's pretty easy. Weaving it all together into the narrative and not have it just be about the stuff, but have it be about characters and have a kind of a narrative drive and a goal. And, you know, that's the difficult part of writing. But again, I mean, I've only been doing this, let's see, November now. Let's see. The Nightly News came out November 1st, 2 years ago. So I'm 2 years and a couple days into this whole gig of making comics. And it seems to me that if you just have a rule of trying to do as good of a job as you can and research everything as thoroughly as you can and working very hard, that you can tell pretty good stories. So,
well, certainly in the short time you've been in the industry, I mean, 2 years is really not all that long. You've definitely made a name for yourself and have, you know, a strong following. So that's certainly to your credit.
Yeah, I'm very appreciative of how people have been. Everybody seems to have been. I don't have a lot of negative things to say. You know, I'm just very fortunate when it comes to that. So, but again, I think that's, I'm trying hard. It's not like I'm getting lucky.
Yeah.
Well, I think that what we want to, as we always remind people, if this sounds interesting, go out to your shop. Tell them that you want Pax Romana. You should be able to pick up an issue off the stands. You know, if your shop carries indie books at all, you should be able to find one. And if the story looks good, you can either, at this point, you should still be able to pick up the individual issues, so you can pick it up in issues. Or if you're someone who likes to read the story all at once in the trade, now's the time. The trade's being solicited in the November preview, so tell your shop owner you want this trade, order a copy for you, and then you'll have it in January when it comes out. And with that, we'd like to thank you for taking a few minutes with us, Jonathan. And any previews before we go, before I let you go, any previews into your next project?
I got a Secret Warriors with me and Brian Bendis and Stefano Caselli coming out in February. It should be in next month's previews. That's the long-awaited Nick Fury book in the Marvel Universe. Should be a pretty big deal. And, you know, I've got some other stuff cooking, but it hasn't been announced yet, so I better not say anything.
Okay,
so,
fair enough.
I'm working. There'll be more stuff out there, and, you know, it's all going good.
Very good. Well, thank you for taking the time with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Anytime, two boys.
Okay, and we have with us right now Jay Ferber, writer and creator of Dynamo 5, as well as other fine comics. The issue that we're talking in particular about right now is Dynamo 5 number 0, which is a really good jumping on point that's in the November previews. But we'll probably stray out and talk a little bit about Dynamo 5 in general, about some of the other books in the Ferberverse as well. Thanks for joining us, Jay.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad to take the time to talk about comics.
So tell us a little bit about Dynamo 5 and your goal with this zero issue, The Day in the Life.
Yeah, Dynamo 5 is, you know, in general, it's the story of the five illegitimate kids of a recently deceased superhero who have been rounded up by his widow, who's a former spy, to basically come together and protect his city. They've each inherited one of his many superpowers. And so collectively, they have all the powers of Captain Dynamo. And, you know, the book's been going on, let's see here, almost 2 years now. Issue 0 comes out between issues 19 and 20. And the point of the 0 issue is to just give people, you know, a very good excuse to check out the book. And, you know, it's 99 cents, so it's one of the best, you know, best bang for your buck out there. It is a shorter issue. It's a 12-page issue that has 10 pages of story and then like a 2-page text recap that covers everything that's happened to Dynamo 5 since issue 1. And then the 10-page story is just, like I said, kind of a day in the life. It's basically your classic Dynamo 5 adventure. You get to see the kids in their civilian lives a little bit. You get to see them, you know, interacting with each other and then, you know, go on a mission with a new villain who first appears in this issue. And it kind of sets things up for the next, you know, six, seven months of the book. So it's a good jumping on point just for the series in general, but it also lays the groundwork for this upcoming story arc. And it's you know, we purposely didn't do kind of a recap issue because, yeah, those give you information, but they're kind of boring for existing readers and stuff. So we chose to just give kind of a day in the life, a classic adventure of the team. This is the kind of stories you can expect in Dynamo 5. And then the recap stuff happens in the two-page text piece that'll really get into the details of you know, the history of the book.
Well, sounds good. And I mean, we're getting half as many pages as in a normal issue, and it's less than half the price, so it's still a good deal, you know, bang for your buck-wise.
Exactly. And it's, you know, at 99 cents, it's something you can pretty safely take a chance on, and I'm hoping that retailers will order it, you know, more heavily than they have been, just in the hopes of, you know, turning new people onto the book. And, you know, so we'll cross our fingers on that front, too.
Yeah, I really like the idea of this kind of a thing, especially when you're setting yourself up for a new story arc to really bring readers up to speed and give folks a chance to, you know, really get to know the characters. So this is pretty good. And we just talked about Dynamo 5 on a recent episode of our weekly comic spotlight. So listeners who missed that one can go and hear a little bit more in-depth review in episode 62 that went up on October 15th. And we talked about issue 17 of Dynamo 5, which is just a couple of issues to go until the zero issue. Now, Jay, one thing I have to ask is the solicit here for this says that it's laying the groundwork for the game-changing 25th issue. I don't want any spoilers or anything, but that then leads me to believe that since this issue comes between issues 19 and 20, that issues 20 through 24 will be kind of a breakneck story arc kind of that's like kind of leading up to something big happening in your 25th anniversary issue.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, issue 19 is kind of the end of the current story arc, which will basically be the end of the third trade paperback. So then issue 0 comes out, that kicks things off. And then 0 and then 20 through 25 are basically a cohesive story. And 25 is at both times kind of the accumulation of this that story arc, but then it spins things off into a whole new direction. And you know, like the solicit said, it is a game changer. And it's one of these changes that is pretty hard to do with a Marvel or DC book, put it that way. It's something that, you know, we're not the first people to have done it, but it is something that will really set us apart, I think. And it's going to change all the characters in a pretty major way. So it's going to be pretty fun.
That sounds good.
It sounds really good. I'm really looking forward to that. This has been one of my favorite titles, especially since it does kind of hang together. It's got its own, you know, I like continuity. That's what I like about superhero books. But this one, since it's kind of got its own pocket continuity, it's not as much to wrap your head around as the entire Marvel or DC universe. And plus, since you are ultimately in control of it, I'm imagining you can pretty much keep it a little more cohesive than when you have so many cooks going in and doing conflicting things that happen a lot of times over in some of the bigger universes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it is. I'm a continuity nut too, in the sense that, you know, I want the individual book I'm reading to have, you know, a cohesive narrative, to remember things that happened and build on that, you know, that something that happens to the character isn't just forgotten about or undone at the end of the issue. So, yeah, I'm crazy about that stuff, too. I just think that, you know, at some point, DC and Marvel kind of go to an excess where, you know, that isn't extended just to one book. It's extended to the whole line of titles where they essentially become one giant book where it's kind of tough to read one without reading the other. And that's something that I'm always wrestling with with Dynamo 5 and Noble Causes and the miniseries that's going on now, Gemini, to make sure that, you know, you never have to read a series you're not already reading. You know, if you read them all, great. You know, you'll get little Easter eggs and you'll recognize some of the characters who cross over, but it's never something where you're going to be lost because you haven't read one of the other books. At least if I'm doing my job right, you won't be.
Well, I think you are because, I mean, while I'm reading all your stuff, I feel that they're all accessible and I don't feel like I had to have read, you know, Noble Causes to understand Dynamo 5 or vice versa. So I certainly think you're doing a good job there.
Yeah, thanks.
Now, the other thing that I think you're doing a good job with is, I mean, just like you're doing with the Zero issue here of a good jumping on point, am I remembering correct that when the first trade of Dynamo 5 came out, it had like 7 issues and had like an under $10 price point?
Yep, yeah, that's exactly right. It was 7 issues and it was $9.95, which is just, you know, first one's cheap, get you hooked, and then... you know, subsequent trades are more competitively priced, but that first one, you know, we really wanted to give you a chance to jump in. And with that line of thinking, anybody who hasn't read Dynamo 5, who's listening to this and is too cheap to even spring for the Zero issue, can go to imagecomics.com, and they have an online comics section where you can read the entire first issue of Dynamo 5 for free. So that's another good way to get a taste of the book.
That's great.
And we'll put the link to that in our show notes. So if you're listening to this, just go to the show notes for this episode, and the link to that online issue of Dynamo 5 number 1 will be in there.
Great.
I think it's great that you're, you know, kind of lowering the barrier to entry for new readers and stuff, because I think with the market the way it is, the economy the way it is, that it's smart for you to be doing that and to make it as easy as possible for people to get on board with your stuff.
Yeah, that's the whole intent, just because, I mean, I know that you know, 99% of the superhero comic book fans are DC and Marvel superhero comic book fans. I mean, that's where they gravitate. So it's, you know, we've got our work cut out for us to kind of try to broaden horizons a little bit and, you know, show them what we're doing over here, our little corner of the Image universe.
Now, one of the other things you've been doing in your books that I find really interesting and I'm really enjoying is the text piece you're doing, Under the Influence. What motivated that? And I guess the question is, you know, what are you trying to do with that? Why are you doing it? And how's that working out for you?
Yeah, I forget when I started it. I think I've done about 6 of them now, so about 6 months ago. And it's just a one-page column that I run, and it goes in all my books, and it's called Under the Influence. And each issue, I talk about a different influence of mine, something that's influenced my writing or, you know, a specific series of mine or something. And it could be comic books, it could be old cartoons, it can be authors or TV shows, you know, basically all these different entertainment forms that influenced me over the years. And the motivation there is really just to try to give the reader a little more bang for your buck. You know, I know that our $350 price tag is kind of a bitter pill to swallow for a lot of people, but it's really kind of the minimum that we can charge and still keep the book going. You know, we experimented with lowering the price tag to $2.99 for a while, and not only did numbers not increase at all, so it didn't make it more attractive to anybody, but it just reduced our profit to the amount where, you know, we would have had to just cancel the book at that price. So, you know, we put it back up to $350, and then I just thought of different ways to just add value to the book that didn't involve adding more pages of story for the regular creative team. And doing that column is one idea. You know, we have letters pages, we run behind the scenes, you know, kind of the material you'd find in a trade paperback with sketchbook stuff and cover designs and that sort of thing. We put that in the monthly book, which, you know, I did not originate. You know, people like Warren Ellis have been doing that for a while in a lot of his books. So it's just a way for us to try to make it more appealing to their monthly reader.
Are those also going to be in the trade paperback, or are those exclusive to the monthly book to kind of give that extra incentive to the people who do support it on an ongoing basis?
Right. The Under the Influence columns are exclusive to the book. They're not going to be appearing online. They're not going to be in the trade paperbacks. You know, we also run pinups, and the pinups will sometimes appear in the trade paperback solely for, you know, if you know, because of the page counts we have to have. If we have a couple odd pages to fill, we'll throw in pinups that have already run. But the Under the Influence columns and a lot of the backup stories, which we're starting to do as well, won't be in the trade paperbacks.
That makes sense. It's just, you know, another incentive for people to be getting the monthly, which of course, you know, we all want them to be doing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, some of the backup stories that we'll be doing will go into the trade because they'll be kind of essential reading to the greater Dynamo 5 narrative. but the stuff that's more just bonus filler, not filler material, but yeah, I guess it is filler material, that stuff won't be in the trade because it's, you know, like I said, just to entice you to pick up the monthly book and to reward you for doing so.
Cool. So what books out there do you think fans of those books would really ought to be reading Dynamo 5 and would just love the thing? I mean, I would equate it with, like, the Teen Titans, you know, certainly Kirkman's Invincible and things like that. What else would you equate it to, and kind of who's not getting this book but really ought to, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that Invincible fans would like it. I mean, Invincible is you know, kind of the poster boy these days for Image Comics superhero stuff. And, you know, he's their big solo character. You know, of course, there's Savage Dragon as well. And we're Dynamo 5, I think, is the new, you know, superhero team aspect of that. So Invincible fans, you know, definitely in the Under the Influence columns, I've talked about what a big fan I am of the old Wolfman Perez Teen Titans and the old New Warriors books. And so, you know, fans of kind of those 80s and 90s super team stuff would definitely like this, I think. So that's what shaped me. As far as, you know, current stuff being published today, honestly, I don't read that much of it. So I don't know exactly what would appeal to people, you know, out there now that should be checking out Dynamo 5. But I, you know, I think a lot of people who are reading comics today were also reading comics in the 80s. So, like I said, the two biggest touchstones are probably the Titans and the Warriors, and the X-Men, obviously, Claremont and the Byrne stuff and the Paul Smith run, that sort of thing. Dynamo 5 is very much, despite the kind of bastard offspring adult factor to it, it really is just my excuse to do a slam-bang classic teenage superhero team. You know, they've got their secret headquarters, they've got their communicator wristwatches and their secret identities and their little domino masks and all that stuff. So it really is just an excuse for me to do a fun superhero book like I used to like to read.
Yeah, and they are older, high school to just out of high school age. So, you know, that's the age range that we're going to. So it's nice and relatable to, I think, a wide range, you know, because kids who are, you know, anywhere, you know, all the way up to adult, but I mean, especially in that junior high school through college range, these characters are not that different in age from them. And then as an older reader, I can remember, you know, loving the same books that you loved and liking that kind of thing. That's why I like it. You know, I can relate to it too. So it does have a wide appeal.
Yeah, thanks. It's it is definitely, you know, the characters do range in age from, you know, our youngest, I think, is a sophomore, sophomore in high school, and the oldest just got out of college a year or so ago. So they range from, you know, 15 or so to about 21, 22. And, you know, they all have... One of the things that I think sets the book apart in this day and age, I think, is that we do try to pay a lot of attention to the whole secret identity stuff. But these characters do have their own identities, and because they are the offspring of this superhero, you know, they're all half-siblings. They have the same father, but they all have different mothers. And so they all have different families. Up until recently, they didn't know about each other. They didn't know about their father. So they've all grown up across the continent with you know, different mothers and fathers who they've known their whole lives. So each kid has his own totally separate supporting cast, and we get to know them to varying degrees as time goes on. Some of the parents find out about their kids' powers, some don't. Sometimes it ends badly, sometimes it doesn't. But that's one of the things that I think is lacking in a lot of superhero books these days, where the superheroes just tend to be superheroes 24 hours a day and, you know, have very little secret identity kind of stuff going on.
I think that's one of the strengths of this book, as well as I think what you're pulling from your influences too, because, you know, you look back at the Titans, especially when Wolfman was doing it, and there was that huge familial feel to the book. And even though those characters, their families were all other superheroes for the most part, you did get a lot of not superhero antics all the time, but you had a lot of them interacting on a personal level. And that's, I think, what makes the book, it gives you that warm feeling where you remember it for years, because it's not just one fight, one action scene to another. You get to know the characters and start caring about the characters. And you're doing that development in Dynamo 5 also, as we start finding out more about the family dynamics that are going on with the different ones. It was interesting on one of the characters there. Mother passed away, but, you know, the father didn't really know that he wasn't her father, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, but even though, you know, it's nice because, you know, she's like, hey, he's Captain Dynamo might have been my biological father, but you're my father. You raised me.
Yeah.
You're my father. And that's nice,
her,
you know.
It's one of the things that really makes these characters a lot more realistic than kind of a lot of the other characters in the Marvel and DC universe and some of the other superhero titles floating about. Because, yeah, a lot of those do tend to boil down to what villain are they fighting this week. You know, so having that depth in the characterization, something I'm really enjoying with Dynamo 5.
Great, thank you. Yeah, one of the kind of landmines I realized I was setting up for myself in this book is that, you know, they're all half-siblings, so we can't go down the whole, you know, kind of staple of having, you know, inter-team romance stuff going on. So there's none of that in this book. They're all, any romantic subplots are with other supporting characters. Otherwise, we'd have to put a mature reader's label on this thing. But that's actually one of the things that, again, that I like about the comics I grew up reading. And, you know, getting back to the Titans, you've got, you know, you had Terry Long and Sarah Sims and you know, these supporting characters that just gave the lead characters lives away from the team. It just made things, you felt like you were following the lives of these characters rather than just a group of superheroes who exist solely to interact with each other. And that's something that we're trying to foster and kind of emulate in some respects.
Yeah, and you've got the fire. There was some interesting interaction there with the Firebirds in, I think it was an issue 17, but I won't spoil it. But, you know, I really liked how that played out, you know, kind of like almost the, you know, hitting on the one character kind of thing. Are you hitting on? You know. But
yeah, the Firebirds are a mother-daughter team, you know, for those of you who aren't reading the book. And they, I had a one-shot with them a couple of years ago. And so I've kind of folded them into Dynamo 5 a little bit. They're going to be supporting characters for a while. And they're just fun because they're a different take on the whole family super team. It's a young mother and her teenage daughter. And they have some past connections with Captain Dynamo as well. So they are filling in currently. The current storyline of the book is that the regular Dynamo 5 team is broken up. And Scrap, one of the members, has formed a kind of a substitute Dynamo 5, formed of various characters, you know, who appeared in my books. So it's fun. It just kind of lets us shake things up a little bit.
It's a good book. I think, again, you know, go back and listen to the episode where we talked about issue 17. You've listened to us talk about this now. If this sounds at all interesting, go follow the link that we've got in the show notes. Check out the first issue that you can read that online. We'll also put some links in there to where you can go and buy Volume 1 online. You know, check your local comic shop first, see if they've got it. But InStock Trades has got it, and Amazon has got it. And we'll put those links in for the first volume of the trade. It's under $10. Really nice to pick up. If you want this book, go now. While your local shop is ordering the zero issue, and tell them that you're interested in this so that they'll order it and you'll be able to pick it up when it comes out in January.
Yes, and you know, while you're telling them, you specify that it is a 99-cent issue. You know, that may encourage them to order a few more copies for the shelf for other people who may be interested in checking it out for the first time. So it's a small investment, I think, on everybody's part.
Yeah, and that's always the hope, is that if you go into the shop and tell the shop owner that you're interested in this book, hopefully they're going to, you know, be wise enough to understand that if one person's actually going to the effort to say that they want this, that means there's probably at least a couple of other people that they have as customers that would also be interested in this book that just aren't speaking up like that. So remind them so that they will order those extra copies and get this into the hands of people, because, boy, again, small investment, and if they get several people who are loving this book, that's just, you know, an extra sale each month as it comes out.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Okay, well, thanks for taking the time with us, Jay, and I'm looking forward to this zero issue, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how this arc from 20 up through 25 goes.
Excellent. The pressure's on. I hope I don't disappoint.
We've got Michael Nelson with us to talk about his new book from Boom Studios called Hexed. And John and I both got a hold of a preview PDF of this and read the issue. I quite enjoyed it, but I'm going to let you, Michael, tell us what the big picture view of this book is and why it's cool.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, first of all, thanks, guys, for having me on. I really appreciate the chance to talk about it. Hexed is The basic concept, it's about a young girl who is a thief. She makes her living as a thief in a dark and magical underworld. And the main character's name is Lucifer. Her name is actually Lucy Jennifer Ignacio das Neves, and she's Brazilian. Those readers who follow Fall of Cthulhu will know who she is. She's also a character in Fall of Cthulhu. But we liked that character so much that we wanted to pull her out of the Fall of Cthulhu universe and put her in her own universe, her own world, and one that isn't dictated by Lovecraftian storytelling or, you know, within that specific mythos. We wanted to give her her own sandbox to play in. And so what we've done is we've kept everything about her character. And, you know, she's a thief. She underwent some, you know, horrible things in her past. And she ends up in a city working for a woman in an art gallery. And unfortunately for Lucifer, some of her past tends to catch up with her. And it's how she deals. This first arc is how she deals with that.
Now, how connected or disconnected is it from the Cthulhu stuff? You're saying it's the same character, but kind of in a different universe? Or how exactly does that work?
Yeah, you know, I really am asking a lot of my readers on this, for those who are following along. Obviously, to enjoy Hex, you don't have to know anything about Fall of Cthulhu. That's not a prerequisite to know what's going on at all. I wanted to make sure that Hex can be enjoyed on its own. But I also wanted to make sure that it's different in tone. When you're writing Lovecraft, it's always very dark and very dour. And even though there's darkness in Hex, I wanted to have that sense of beauty, that brightness, the fact that it is possible to have a happy ending. Doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be one, but it's possible. In Lovecraft, there are no happy endings. You know, it's, you know, the good guys don't run off into the sunset. And so also what I wanted to do is I wanted to give her her own universe. I didn't want to have, you know, when you're dealing with the Cthulhu mythos, you have such a rich tapestry of creatures and characters that have been in existence for 80 years. And, you know, that comes with a lot of baggage. And the thing is, I wanted to make sure that if readers read Hex and they are familiar with Lovecraft, that they didn't come in with preconception. What we did was we pulled Lucifer out in a way that we're not negating all the things that happened to her in Fall of Cthulhu. We just don't really mention them specifically in Hex. You know, there are some other characters from Fall of Cthulhu that I bring over into Hex, but they're all characters of my own creation. Everything in Hex is my own. And, you know, and that's one of the things that makes me so excited about this project, is that it's the first project that I've written that's all mine and not something that was somebody else's concept or in somebody else's, you know, pre-existing universe. This is all my own. And so I'm kind of asking readers to, you know, accept the fact that her past took place in another universe. You know, it's sort of like when in Hex, when, you know, we mentioned these horrible events that happened 3 years ago, but referencing the events in God War and Apocalypse. Even though we don't mention specifically what happened, I'm hoping that readers just sort of take it on faith that something horrible happened. And if you want to know specifically what it is, you can go read Fall of Cthulhu, but it isn't important to understand or enjoy Hex.
So I read the first issue, and I had no knowledge that this was a character from Fall of Cthulhu, so I didn't feel like I was lost or anything, so you were successful on that. Now,
okay, good.
Is there a specific, if I wanted to go find those issues of Fall of Cthulhu, is it like a mini-series, God War, or is it like a, tell me where I would go if I wanted to read that, although I understand I don't have to necessarily.
Absolutely. Well, the first time we see her is in the Gray Man arc, and she's actually one of the main characters of that arc. That's actually, I believe it starts with issue 11 of the entire Fall of Cthulhu series, and that actually comes out in trade very soon. In fact, I just saw an advanced copy of the trade today, which just looks gorgeous. So if you want to read about Lucifer and her past, the best way to do that is to pick up the Gray Man arc. And then, of course, she's in the rest of the series as well. She's in Fall of Cthulhu, God War, and Apocalypse.
Are those miniseries?
Yes. It's sort of like the Gray Man is a miniseries within the Fall of Cthulhu, and then God of War and Apocalypse are miniseries as well.
But they're not within the numbering of the normal Fall of Cthulhu? Are they called Fall of Cthulhu, God War?
Yes, it's Fall of Cthulhu, God War, and Fall of Cthulhu, Apocalypse.
Cool. It sounds like a great approach to continuity where you've kind of got the backstory if somebody wants to go investigate it, but not a prerequisite to enjoying Hexed. Because when I read Hexed, no clue it spun out of anything else in any way, shape, or form. I found it very accessible, very enjoyable. And I think that's a definite credit to you in a couple of respects, because I generally don't do anything horror-related whatsoever for the most part. So the odds of me picking up any kind of a Cthulhu story, really low.
Right.
But I really enjoyed Hexed.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, that was a conscious thing. You know, it was something that, because we knew Hexed, we knew what we wanted to do with Hexed. We knew it was going to be different tonally, both visually and in storytelling. And we just wanted to make sure that it was accessible to readers that just want to read a good story. And, you know, they don't have to be big on horror. And another thing, too, is that, you know, it's really difficult anytime you're dealing with a character that has a huge history. You know, it's sort of like sometimes you just want to be able to jump into a story, know what's going on, you know, immediately know who the character is. You know, knowing they have a past is fine, you know, as long as knowledge of that past, of the specifics of the past, are necessary to enjoy the story. And that's what I wanted to make sure with this, was that I wanted to make sure readers, you know, if you want to know more about her, it's there, but you don't have to. Because there, you know, it's kind of frustrating sometimes when you walk in, you realize there's just this encyclopedia of continuity that you have to know to understand half of what you're reading. And it can be kind of frustrating to a new reader who's just jumping in. And, you know, to be honest, you know, I'm still a new guy. I'm still, you know, kind of low on the totem pole. And so a lot of readers aren't that familiar with me or what I do. So a lot of readers are going to be jumping in for the first time, and I want to make sure that they don't get lost or frustrated when they do.
Well, that makes sense, because while I'm a big fan of continuity in the mainstream superhero universes and a longtime reader of those universes, you know, I find myself sometimes getting frustrated simply because I can't remember certain aspects of the backstory, which are kind of vaguely alluded to or whatever, and I feel sometimes those stories lack a certain accessibility that would be nice. And again, here in this first issue of Hexed, I think you did a wonderful job on that. Now, how much of that is kind of part and parcel of trivia god Mark Waid being over at Boom and kind of his experience both with the big picture continuities at Marvel and DC and just, you know, as a story writer? Has he had much input or shaped your views on this, or is this something you kind of, you know, brought to the table yourself?
As far as the continuity, I guess that's something that I brought to the table myself. The wonderful thing that Mark has done is, I mean, we all know that Mark is a master storyteller. And so there have been times where I'll go into his office and I'll say, Mark, I've got this idea, but I'm stuck. I don't know where to go from here. And he has just this knack of being able to break down a story to its basic elements and say, okay, well, what are you trying to say? You know, what do your characters want? What's the conflict? I mean, he knows what makes a good story, and he's able to sort of like take away all the stuff, I don't want to say inconsequential, but the things that I'm obsessing over, the details that I'm focusing on. He has a way of sort of like putting that to the side and getting me to focus on what really matters. And that's the core of the story. And he has a way to be able to break that down in a way that I'm like, oh, that even an idiot like me can understand and say, oh, okay, I got it. And then what he'll do, and this is what's great about Mark, is that he doesn't tell you what you should do. You know, he may come up with some general suggestions, but he trusts in all of his writers and creators. Like, this is he helps us find what the problem is, and then he guides us to find the solution. He doesn't give us the solution. He guides us to find the solution, and that way it makes us better in the process. And then, you know, he's just an amazing teacher that way. It's sort of like, okay, this is where your problem is, and, you know, there are a couple of different ways that, you know, you can fix it. You can go this way, that way, or that way. And usually when you're sitting in the room, it's like, oh, well, I could do this. And he's like, well, then there you go. That's problem solved. It's done. You know, and so I'm always feeling so much better coming out of a meeting with Mark, because it's like, oh, you go in with all this weight on your shoulder thinking that the story's just going to fall apart. And then he's able to very quickly and succinctly say, okay, this is what your problem is, and here are some possible solutions. And usually, you know, you have the problem fixed in 5 minutes. So
That's cool, because it sounds like he's very much acting as kind of a story coach and not trying to be the storyteller, which is his role as editor. I mean, that's the perfect thing.
We've been talking a lot lately on some of our other shows about the role of the editor and the way you just described what Mark is doing is exactly what we've been talking about what an editor should do, you know, where they're helping you tell a crisper, more concise story that's going to draw the reader in and be more accessible.
Exactly,
that's what
exactly.
they should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the thing is, with someone like with Mark's experience, who knows so much about story and has so much to teach, you know, he really has a way to sort of like step back and look at the macro and say, this is what's going on, this is what's broken, this is what needs to be fixed. He's just brilliant at it.
Well, and it sounds like it's able to help you and the other writers and creators at Boom tell the best stories you guys have, you know, in the best manner possible, and I think that's great.
Exactly.
Now, this is something you were saying that, you know, you've pulled out of the Cthulhu stuff, but it's your own creation and you know, all kind of yours in that respect. You got long-term plans for this? I know it's a four-issue miniseries. Are we likely to see more afterwards?
You know, I really, really hope so. You know, I already have story ideas in my head. I love this character. I love the character of Lucifer. I love the character of Val Brisendine, her boss. And, of course, you know, if you've read the first issue, you know that we mentioned the harlot. So, you know, I love that character, and what Emma is doing with that character is just brilliant. There's so much that I love about these characters in this universe that I would just love to keep telling stories, you know, about her. But the problem is, you know, unfortunately, it's not always up to me. You know, I mean, I'd write it all the time, but, you know, it's really up to the publisher to say whether or not it's, you know, a title that's viable and that, you know, is worth moving forward. I think that it's going to be, and there's, you know, and definitely the story ideas are there, and everyone in the office loves the story and loves the book and wants to see it succeed. So, but, you know, sometimes, you know, these kinds of things are out of our hands, so we've got our fingers crossed.
Well, overall, you know, having read the preview PDF that you sent, I really enjoyed it. The question I would have personally to help me determine, you know, is this something I want to be getting or not, is there was one section that was, you know, a little graphical and gory and stuff. Is there going to be more of that going forward? Is that just something that's used where needed? Because it fit where it was in the story. It's not something that could have been, you know, kind of glossed over or removed. It needed to be there, I think.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I mean, obviously, and I think that people that have read a lot of my stuff understand that I have a bit of a dark side when it comes to my writing. And, you know, with this particular story, yes, there will be more of that. But also, that's something that I'm trying to explore with this character. There's a reason that I have her working in an art gallery, and that's because she is surrounded by such ugliness constantly. You know, she has to open up a corpse to create a portal into a demon realm. And the fact that she does this on a regular basis, you know, it begins to take a toll on you. And so that's why I wanted the idea of her in an art gallery, because she wants to be able to surround herself with beauty. The idea that she's like ideal in filth all the time. When I'm done, I just want to be able to sit down and look at beautiful things. And so I think it adds a nice contrast. But then again, it's sort of like there are other options for her in life. You know, she doesn't really have to be a supernatural thief if she doesn't want to be, but that's the life that she chooses for herself. And sort of, you know, it sort of gets into her internal conflict and, you know, the greater conflict that she has. So the idea of it being kind of gory and unsettling, that is something that's going to be a constant in the stories, you know. And so, you know, for readers that really don't get into that, you know, I totally understand if they just want to, you know, pass on it because they're just not really big on that graphic stuff. But I personally think that it's important. It's not gore just for gore's sake.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I'm not big on is like torture porn. That stuff just, you know, that doesn't do it for me. If there's a reason for it, yes. And for me, it's sort of like I wanted to be able to show that sometimes the world, this world of magic, can be very, very ugly, and it's how she deals with that. And I think that's an interesting part of her character.
Yeah, well, and it certainly, you know, the gory scene, you know, fit in the story, and, you know, I like how you're using it for that counterpoint and stuff like that to kind of balance things out or what have you.
Yeah.
So it certainly fits, and it's not the least bit gratuitous, which I respect.
Oh, Good. Yeah, because you know, sometimes, you know, you wonder, you know, if you know, sometimes you walk that fine line of, you know, how far can I go? That's one thing that Bloom is always doing, and that's kind of like pulling me back, which is a good thing. If they published the stuff that I really wanted to, they would not be good for anyone. So they have a good eye as far as like where the line needs to be drawn. And, you know, I try to go up to that line, and sometimes I'll try to peek over the line, but, you know, they make sure that I never cross that line.
Cool.
So one more question for you, and that is, okay, so we've taken Lucifer out of the Fall of Cthulhu stories, and you've used her in a pretty decent number of stories over there now. If she was in a full arc in Fall of Cthulhu, as well as two other Fall of Cthulhu miniseries, are you going to continue to use her in the Fall of Cthulhu universe, or now that you've spun the character off into the Hexed universe, which is different, are you going to just carry Lucifer forward in that universe and stop using her in Fall of Cthulhu?
Yeah, I don't think she's going to show up in Fall of Cthulhu again. The way it's developed is that when I first started Fall, there was sort of a, even though I was telling the story in individual arcs, there was sort of this meta story going on underneath. And after Apocalypse, that meta story is pretty much wrapped up. Now, granted, I go on to tell another story arc after that. But I think that what's going to happen is when the Fall of Cthulhu universe continues after all of that, it's going to be with a new set of characters. So I wanted to make sure that Lucifer is her own thing. She's off in her own world and, you know, isn't going to be, you know, pulled back into the Fall of Cthulhu universe, because I think that's not where I want her to be anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just want her in her own world doing her own thing. So it's sort of like she's graduated now. She was in high school before, now she's in college and, you know, going off that way.
Sounds good.
Very good. I'm looking forward to it. The issue that is in this previews is actually issue number 2. Issue number 1 was solicited last month, and we just weren't able to sync up with you last month to talk to you. So we would encourage everyone, if this sounds interesting, to let your shop know. They can probably still put in an order for issue number 1. That's especially important since it is from Boom. Boom's a great company, but a lot of comic shops, at least ones I've been into, they don't necessarily carry Boom books unless somebody asks for them. So go to your shop and ask for the book so that your shop owner can order it for you.
Really quickly, I just want to mention that the artwork is being done by Emma Rios doing the line art and Chris Peters doing the colors, and it's gorgeous. It's simply gorgeous. So, you know, if you're not impressed by what I'm saying here, at least take a look at the book and see what these girls are doing with it, because they're doing just amazing work.
Thank you very much. And with us now, we have two people related to the Outer Spacemen graphic album, actually the original graphic novel that's coming out next month. We have Eric Hayes, who is the writer, and we have Gary Schaefer, who is the owner of the Outer Spacemen property and also the publisher of this volume. Thanks for being with us today, guys.
Thank you, Bob.
Eric, why don't you start us off by giving us a little bit of a flavor of maybe a little bit of the genesis of the story, and then tell us about the story itself.
Okay, no problem. You know, I'm a colleague of Gary Schaefer, and I knew that he had the copyright on this line of toys, and he'd been kicking around an idea of a comic book, and he worked with several other writers, and nothing was really going right. And so I figured, I'll take a shot. And he said, run with it. So we worked together on the graphic novel, and we liked the story, and we think people are going to want to read it. So we did pretty much a worldwide talent search on the art, and came up with this 150-page graphic novel. Basically, you know, Earth is in terrible danger again, and it's going to fall upon the outer spacemen, an unseen team of interplanetary peacekeepers that represent each of the planets of the solar system, the best of each of the planets of the solar system. and they organize to defeat an old enemy that has come back from the depths of the earth to put Earth in danger once again. And, you know, there's these disappearances taking place on Earth. Nobody can explain the connection to these important people that seem to be disappearing around the world. And the outer spacemen are going to be the only people that are going to be able to save Earth and stabilize the solar system and, you know, basically save the day.
Now, the outer spacemen themselves are these, I don't mean this derogatorily, but they're like these weird looking alien type of characters. And they are based on some toys, from the past, little different, space guys. And, you know, one guy's got tentacles and another guy's, you know, kind of reptilian and all this kind of stuff. And I remember these from when I was a kid, and they're just these interesting little toys. So, Gary, why don't you tell us a little bit about the toys and the actual outer spacemen characters themselves?
In 1967, Mattel Toy Corporation was doing about $10 million a year, which at the time was completely unheard of, on a line of toys called Major Matt Mason. This was Mattel's Man in Space. Major Matt Mason was the leader of this advanced space exploration team, and along with Sergeant Storm and Doug Davis, they were exploring space for the Earth to gain knowledge and experience. Now, there were about 50 to 100 different toys that Major Matt Mason actually had and you could buy as separate ancillary toys. The Coliforms Corporation at the time was watching this $10 million operation in business, and they had been watching since 1966, when in fact National Periodicals, or what is today DC Comics, licensed Batman. They had been watching $10 million of Batman fly across the United States and the world in licensing deals. Unheard of monies for that time. Now, the Coliforms Corporation, they were at the time doing these vinyl peel-and-stick two-dimensional diorama-like toys. They, like everybody else, were receiving licensing agreements across the board, from Batman to Popeye to Superman to Beverly Hillbillies. Everybody had licensing agreements. It was the rage of the toy industry. So there was this young artist living down on the Lower East Side with his new wife and his first daughter, and he had applied to the Coliforms Corporation to do some freelance work. He met the owner of the Coliforms Corporation, who instantly fell in love with him. This guy's name is Mel Fernkrankin. The owner of the company, Harry Kiss, said to Mel one night, "Why don't you come up with some incredible concept for me? I would love to get into something new." Mel had seen the success that licensing had proven across the country in pieces like Batman and Major Matt Mason. And Mel had a concept which was seven creatures representing one of the best that their planet could offer, coming together to form this intergalactic space peacekeeping team. And he wanted to make them either friend or foe to Major Matt Mason, because up until that point, there were no enemy toys in the world. When there was World War II, you had all hero toys. You never had bad guys. You had to make toys into bad guys. So it was really incumbent upon the kid playing with the toy as to whether or not he wanted to decide if the people are good or bad. Here was an opportunity drawn to scale, almost built to scale, to Major Matt Mason, to have seven creatures be either friend or foe to Major Matt Mason. These seven creatures were actually based wholly and greatly in part on actual other images that Mel had seen throughout his life. For example, Commander Comet, the golden man with wings, actually came from a Raymond Villeneuve book, which was almost Satan devil worship, which as an art student in Paris, Mel had seen the artwork and never forgotten it. And it's an image of Saint Michael doing battle with Satan as only Raymond Villeneuve could have drawn. Colossus Rex, the gigantic reptilian creature from Jupiter. He was really something taken from the cover of Monsters magazine, as well as a little cross-referencing with It, the creature from the movie It came from beyond stars or beyond the planets. Mel actually got in a little trouble after Astronautilus was created, the guy with tentacles, because he's very, very reminiscent, physically reminiscent, of a Hindu god. And there was a certain group in the United States that brought a lawsuit against Coliforms to see if they could retrieve any money because of the image being so like one of their Hindu gods. It was really Electron Plus, the silver guy, that was directly taken from something called The Man from Planet X, a really good cult B-rated film from the 1950s. And Alpha 7, Little Green Man from Mars, he was pretty standard. It was Zodiac, who plays a very big role in the graphic novel. He's got the red hair and the blue suit. That was just completely made up. Orbitron, the large guy with the exposed brain, is in fact the Metaluna mutant. So many of the images that Mel had seen throughout his life, he had copied and recapitulated and created this line of toys. And for one solid year, these toys sold really, really well. As a matter of fact, there were 500,000 units which came into the United States from overseas. And if you divided that by the seven, you'd find that there were about 75,000 of each one of these characters sold. Now, that was intrinsically difficult for Coliforms to accomplish because at the time, this was more or less door-to-door sales by their sales representatives from the Coliforms Corporation going to each independent toy store with brochures and posters and all sorts of stuff that that the toy store owners would take a shot and order a bunch of them. And for one year, they sold really, really well. Not on the line of Major Matt Mason, but good enough for the Coliforms Corporation to turn around and say, okay, we're going to do a second series now. So even as the first series was being produced, they saw the sales numbers coming in. Mel immediately began work on the second series. It is truly unfortunate, or bittersweet, that when man stepped on the moon in July of 1969 and no great horrific creature leapt from the surface of the moon and tore Neil Armstrong's face off, it was tragic and bittersweet that we had basically considered space was conquered. Nobody had thought about going beyond the moon. Every kid had Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon, where Ming the Merciless was from the moon. Well, or Planet Mongo, who was basing himself on the moon. But once we had achieved going to the moon, all toy companies that night declared space was dead. They would not manufacture another space toy. All space toys were just stopped, pulled from the shelves, thrown into sale buckets, and we would not see another influential, monumental space toy movement until May of 1977, when in fact Star Wars was released. Then our imaginations were able to transcend the confines of our own solar system. We would have actually now thought about going into the universe. Galaxies were no longer challenges to us because we had conquered light speed by the brilliant mind of George Lucas and his characters that he created. Although Star Trek had influenced the generation of the 60s with their warp speed, it really was man's landing on the moon that killed everything. So unfortunately, the second series, Outer Spacemen, which they tried to quickly rename overnight the World of the Future, ultimately, within hours of renaming them the World of the Future, was in fact scrapped. It was only six full sets of carded figures of the second series that made it to the United States, and we know exactly where all six are. They are really one of the holy grails, iconic collectibles of toy guys today, to ever even see one, no less own one. These poor, unfortunate six new figures, which one, by the way, I'll give you a hint, is in the book that Eric has so brilliantly written. These six guys were never really produced other than those six carded figures. However, the original seven Outer Spacemen still do appear from time to time on their original blister packaging, commanding tremendous premiums on eBay. Even the loose figures, as long as there are no broken wires in decent condition, they go for several hundreds of dollars. So what I wanted to do when I met Mel and really just fell in love with this guy and would visit his incredible museum-like home with over 10,000 exposed toys and custom cabinetry, what I really talked to him about doing was bringing the Outer Spacemen back, certainly to match up for the 40th anniversary, but really to bring back something that I don't believe and Mel doesn't believe kids have anymore today, which are great toys. And I had kicked around the idea whether or not it would have been a graphic novel or a new line of toys The toy line would have been prohibitively expensive without guaranteed orders, and I didn't want my toys, you know, sitting in beautiful blister packaging, real excellent labors of love. I didn't want them sitting on shelves at Tower Record, which doesn't even exist anymore, Urban Outfitters, or comic stores, where there are infinite rows and rows of action figures sitting there competing against one another and going absolutely nowhere because nobody buys them. I said to myself, let me do a graphic novel. Let me register these names, which took 6 full years to register all the names, because many of the marks and the names were, in fact, used or in process of being used by others. But I did win the day at the end of 6 years, and I did get all 13 registrations, the 7 original figures and the 6 second series figures. And I said, let me go find a great mind and build this book. And I was fortunate enough to know Eric. And Eric, I believe, wrote a brilliant book. Eric as well discovered tremendous talent out of the Philippines and Argentina in the illustrator and the colorist and letterer. And I really believe that this book is a real museum, Marvel-type quality comic book art that will capture everybody. But the key here is the cross-genre, because we need people to remember the outer spacemen, to remember the love of sitting on their grandmother's floor on Christmas morning, popping open the packages, just like me, playing with them, because there are no toys today. Everybody is so wrapped up in the computer and so wrapped up in, you know, the electronic games we plug into our TV. We've lost, I believe, a tremendous sense of the idea of what is independent, autonomous play. It's like there's no imagination anymore. Our imagination is handed to us on a silver platter by games delivered by Wii and Nintendo and the computer. So here's an opportunity for people to A, remember the outer spacemen, B, see them recreated and reconstructed for the new millennium with fantastic bodies and tremendous new personality, persona, perspective. And then for the people that have never heard of them, find something new and heroic that they are going to fall in love with. And I truly believe that the outer spacemen can occupy a niche which I don't believe is occupied right now. Today we sit there and watch Iron Man and Spider-Man and all the Marvel movies based on comic books. I would like to start seeing movies based upon fantastic toys of the past. And here I believe with the release of the G.I. Joe movie coming, there might be a movement toward building a reconstruction of these original fantastic toys in, if nothing else, Saturday morning cartoons, full-length feature films, or even standardized monthly comic books. But I truly believe the outer spacemen are so fantastic in their new form and in their original conceptual form that people will rediscover or fall in love with them once again.
Well, you certainly have a strong passion for these toys. And, you know, I think you make some good points about today. I think that, I mean, there are some kids that play. I mean, the kids who can actually wrest an action figure away from an adult who is storing it mint in package somewhere actually does get some play value out of action figures today. I mean, there are still action figures of superheroes and, you know, a lot of movie tie-in stuff, which isn't as much independent. But I think for a lot of kids, not as many as it used to be, certainly because of the video games and things like that. But there are certainly a good number of kids who do get some play from action figures now. But I think it's a very small percentage of what it used to be. Because,
yeah,
you know, playing with the toys, that was your videotape, you know, really, because there was no videotape then. You know, if you wanted to have that new adventure, and you would use those toys. So I think that's something that is not as much today.
Yes, the videotape ran in your head, not actually in front of you. That's correct.
So, Eric, going back to the comic for a moment, or the original graphic novel that you've got here, tell us a little bit about the talent search that you went through to find Rudolph Montemayor, who is the artist, and he's done an extremely nice job. I've seen the first 40 or so pages of the graphic novel, and very nice art that's in it. And, I agree with Gary, by the way, that it is art that you could hold up against any other art that's out there in comics.
Well, that's great. Thanks, because, you know, it was a long process, because the book was completely written, and we didn't want to start illustrating until we were positive we got the best available talent. And we started locally. We're in Manhattan, and we started with some of the visual arts schools. And we had a lot of people come in and do sketches for us and even do a few pages. And these were really talented artists, but they just weren't getting the, you know, innocence of the original characters, but, you know, in a more modern, updated look. So, you know, it was either one or the other. It would look really cool and stylized, but it just didn't give you the feeling of, wow, this is the same character from the 60s. And so we had to go international, and we posted jobs online. And I was sitting at the computer going through my emails one day, and Rudolph Montemayor sent me a couple sketches of the characters, and he sent me a picture of our man from Venus, Commander Comet, fighting Buzz Lightyear, and he had our guy from Jupiter, Colossus Rex, like, smashing the Hulk, and I just was totally blown away, and he nailed it, and we didn't have to make any changes, and I emailed him right back. I'm like, when can you start? And I just remember emailing Gary. I'm like, we can stop working. We have the penciler and the inker. We can start illustrating now. And so that was on just like a freelance artist website. And I know Bob and John, you're both on Comic Space. And I have a profile on Comic Space. And that's how I just went through all the colorists. And they submitted, you know, examples. I sent them a black and white page. And they would send me back a colored, finished colored and lettered page. And Mark Borstel from Argentina just, again, totally blew me away. I'm like, bullseye. We can stop looking. He's nailing it. And that's how we got started. And it's a long process. I think when we got involved with this, we had no idea how long it takes to pencil and ink a page and color and letter a page. And once you go through all the changes, it really takes a full year to illustrate something that's around 150 pages. But we're incredibly satisfied with the end result. It is amazing. And, you know, of course, I think that this is one of the more epic stories you're going to read in comic form. But even if you don't agree, the art is beautiful. Just flipping through the page will just blow you away. So if you read comics for the art, this is for you. If you read comics for the story, this is for you also. And I just really dig the kind of retro look that Rudolph has on it, because the characters use ray guns, because it's from the 60s. You know, the man from Venus has a crossbow, and it's totally kind of retro, but in a modern day setting. And I'm just really blown away by how the finished product looks.
Yeah. Now I will point out, I mean, it is kind of like a retro sci-fi story. You have the different outer spacemen are from different planets in the solar system, and, you know, you've got the ray guns, as you said, and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, if that's – and that's not everyone likes that kind of genre, right? But people right. who do like that genre, I think, are going to enjoy this. But you just got to look at it and say, well, if you like that retro sci-fi kind of stuff, this is something you definitely want to check out.
And that's pretty much where Gary and I are both coming from. We're both lifelong Star Trek fans. We're both huge Star Wars fans. So, and all those, you know, movies from the 50s and 60s that some of the characters are based on, that's kind of right in our wheelhouse as far as movies go. So yeah. It's no wonder that this is what the final product looks like.
Yeah, but, you know, I would not compare it as much to Star Trek as more to maybe some of the, even though it came out in the 60s, more of the, I'm trying to think of like maybe even like Day the Earth Stood Still or more of the 50s kind of sci-fi, because it's not the futuristic sci-fi like Star Trek. You know, it's like where Star Trek is, you know, set in the distant future, from the 60s. This is more like it's sci-fi kind of grounded in the era. Right.
Right.
Kind of. And as you said, I mean, it is grounded in, you know, I think Gary pointed out, it's grounded in the era where sci-fi still had, you know, spacemen living on the different planets of our solar system before we kind of got out and said, okay, well, there isn't really any life out there. So, they pushed it back, right? They made it other solar systems, other star systems out farther away. Right. But it's nice retro feel because you can kind of get your head back around it and get back into it and say, okay, you know, I remember when, you know, and it's a story, right? So it's, you can still appreciate that story because it's not like every story has to be completely grounded in science fact. I mean, it's just, to me, it's almost like, a fantasy story has just fantastical elements that you know are not grounded in science fact, but you can appreciate that fantasy story. This is a sci-fi story that has those same kind of fantastical elements that you just kind of go with it for the purposes of the story.
Yes, now you have to remember that a lot of the characters are actually based on 1950s images. Like I said before, It Came from Beyond and The Man from Planet X. There is a reminiscence, almost a romantic feeling to the outer spaceman because it reminds you of a time where, in fact, Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and Ming the Merciless on Mongo, you know, did in fact capture and absolutely make every kid fall in love with the idea of space exploration. Today, you know, what's amazing is that we have become so technologically savvy. We have space platforms. We have Hubble telescopes. We have deep space probes. We have ideas that we could get to Mars on ion power. We have concepts that were originally developed in people's imaginations in the 1950s. And whereas life imitates art for certain in these days that we live in, here's an opportunity for people to, yes, like you say, reminisce about a retro idea, but still, just like Fantastic Four number 47, when the Watcher appeared to help the Fantastic Four defend the Earth against Galactus and the coming of the Silver Surfer, the outer spacemen are omnipresent. Thousands of years they have existed, tens of thousands, and made sure that there was peace inside the solar system. Thousands of years they've watched the development of people, and that idea has been touched on in Fantastic Four, in Star Trek, in ideas of the Sentinel series, where there are these groups of people that look out and make sure we don't kill ourselves. Well, you know, here's an opportunity for people, yes, to reminisce about those old days, but still I think because of the art, because I still, at the end of the day, think people are more visual than literate, and I'm sorry to say that, Eric, because you wrote a great story. I still think people today will look at the incredible artwork and just be amazed, and for not one split moment, be allowed to go back and remember what it was like to be a kid, to imagine all on your own, and to say, wow, where has a story like this been? Because these seven guys are just really super.
I don't remember if we mentioned, what's the actual street date for the book? When's it going to be available in shops?
The purchase order will come through in the first week in December. So we're looking probably somewhere December 15th to the 20th. It's out.
For ordering this, it is in the November previews catalog. It's on page 298 under the Outer Spacemen LLC. You'll be able to order this. If this has sounded interesting at all to you, your shop owner is going to be ordering this now. So go to your shop, tell them you want a copy of it, point them to page 298 of the previews catalog that's out and current right now, and your shop owner should be able to order a copy of this, and it'll be right there in your hands when it hits the streets. We'll also put a link to their website on the show notes. And with that, I'd like to thank you both, Eric and Gary, for joining us and talking about the Outer Spacemen.
Thank you, Bob and John.
Thank you, okay. Bob and John.
We've got with us now Mark Long and Nick Sagan, who are the creators of the Shrapnel World and series, which is a new series coming out from Radical Comics. You'll find it on page 301 of the November previews catalog for books shipping in, or actually hitting the stands in January. And I want to take this opportunity to let Mark and Nick talk about Shrapnel and tell us a little bit about the world. And it's a sci-fi based series and what we can expect.
Great.
So I'll toss it over to you guys.
Hi, this is Mark Long.
I'm Nick Sagan.
Let's see, where should we begin, Nick?
Well, I think it started many years ago, actually. Mark and I know each other from working on the Zork Nemesis video game back in the day, which was, late 90s, early 90s?
Yeah, it was like 1994, and on that project, it was a really deep story, deep puzzle game, if you know the Zork franchise at all. And we would meet in Los Angeles for a week at a time, every couple of weeks for a couple of months. And we had the opportunity to get to know each other, and we discovered this mutual interest in Greek literature and, of course, science fiction. And that's really the genesis of Shrapnel, the idea of those two things mixed together.
And we were talking for the longest time. We just sort of clicked on those topics. And I think we were at one point talking about the idea of a science fiction revolution story. And originally, I think it started as a sort of a revolution on Mars. And then many years later, we just started talking about it. And Mark took the initiative, and it's just sort of exploded into what you have before you hear.
We started on the book about 3 years ago, actually. I asked Nick if he'd be interested in taking the idea. He had actually written a treatment, the basis of the story. And I asked him if he wanted to produce it as a graphic novel, and he agreed. And I went off to Comic-Con in search of a writer, and that's where we met Zach Sherman. And Zach was selling his book, SEAL Team 7, at the Image booth. And I picked it up, and it was just instantly clear that he had a really great storyline in his book, the interesting hook, you know, basically the underwater world of Atlantis versus the Earthlings. And SEAL Team 7 goes after them. And he joined us about a month later. I think it took us about 6-9 months to write the book. Is that right?
Yeah, we did a lot of sort of story conferences, and then Zach went and did Magic. He's a great writer. He's actually, it's really funny because I've known him for years. He's a friend of the family. It was when Mark found him, I was like, wow, Zach Sherman? So it was really great to sort of work with him again. It's really a dream come true to work with both these guys.
Tell us on the comic book, okay? So we've got this first series that's coming out, and that's what's the first issue of the first series is being solicited for January. And you were mentioning before we started recording that you're already talking about a second series and a third series. So kind of give us a little bit of an overview of the world, what it's about, some of the key characters, and kind of the basic story arc that we'll see and your vision for the series. And give our listeners an idea of, you know, why this is cool and what about it that they might resonate with that would make them want to go out and get this ordered.
It's hard to sell, you think, here. Huh?
Yeah. Well, yes.
Yeah, that's the whole point. I mean, let's get people excited about this.
It's an arcing series around the future. It's a science fiction story about what might happen, looking, you know, where we are in terms of our hopes of colonizing the solar system, and looking at the inescapability of human nature. That no matter where our technology takes us to, and our destination to take over wherever we can, we're still sort of looking at the same flaws that we have as human beings. So we have a really epic story.
Following up on what Nick's saying, Plato, I think, said the only ones that have seen the end of war are the dead, which is his point. Human nature would bring us back to war, even though we might reach out into the solar system. And so what we've produced is a epic, in the Greek sense, epic trilogy. And the first book that the series represents, our heroine is living on Venus. She's kind of hiding out from a war that she wants to get away from. The solar war is all really almost over between the International Union, which is Earth, and the colonial armies. We saw the colonies growing like the Greek city-states, and each one with kind of their own flavor of democracy. And as their economic power grows, they become a threat to the Earth, and Earth is kind of warm, polluted, kind of maybe corrupt, and the colonies represent the new world. And our character is a what we call a helot, or the correct Greek pronunciation is helot. If you know your Greek history, helots were the slaves of Sparta. They were the reason that Spartans could have a warrior culture, because there were five helot slaves for every Spartan citizen. And helots are kind of the genetic have-nots in our future world. And she is given her freedom by the International Union and joins the Marines out of gratitude, out of patriotism, and fights in the beginning of the Solar War for 5 years, but then is involved in an infamous incident that results in many civilians' death. And she is partially blamed for this. And at the beginning of the book, she's gone AWOL. And like Ripley, kind of in Aliens 2, she's hiding out in a menial job on one of the more remote colonies, which is Venus. And the war has finally come to Venus, and she wants nothing to do with it. And her friends are, like young men do, kind of eager to get involved in a fight, and she tells them, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And in this first book, she ends up surprising everybody with her combat skills and then leadership. And by the end of the first book, I don't want to give too much away, but she's vanquished the Marine army and is basically in charge of all forces on Mars. I'm sorry, on Venus. And in the second book, the second part, I usually describe this kind of as Lawrence of Arabia in space. She, now their victory looks begins to look like a defeat, because the Marines are waiting them out outside the planet. And she volunteers to take a small force to the Earth's moon, where helium-3 is mined. As Nick said, we're very much trying to write a science fact story as much as science fiction, so we're trying to base everything in some kind of technical reality. And this is something that, by the way, we shared with Sid Mead when Nick brought Sid in to do the original concept designs on our mech suits. The three of us really were adamant that everything be based in, you know, all our ideas based in some sort of technical reality, because it was just so much more rich for us that way. Anyway, she leads a small force on a series of reprisal raids and is successful, but in the middle of that campaign, the colonies behind her sue for peace, and she's told to lay down her weapons and abandon her army, and she refuses. You know, she's fighting for something bigger now. At the same time, kind of like Lawrence, she begins to believe the myth that surrounds her as a helot. The other helots in the colonies are making her a hero. So she leads her army back, this time to Mars, where she defeats the very government that she's was fighting for. And then by the third book, which we have tentatively titled Nemesis, and this is the Greek meaning, not the the modern meaning of Nemesis, which is kind of the bill to come due for hubris, she receives the Earth's emissaries, and they tell her, you may have been able to lead a ragtag army out here in the colonies, but you'll never be able to manage them. We'll just wait you out. But through a series of other clever maneuvers, she ends up seizing the remaining colonies and arrays her army to head for Earth for a final stand down. And the book ends with, or the trilogy ends with her taking her army onto the plains of Shanghai, where the two forces fight. So a lot of our themes are very, I sometimes tell people shrapnel is the Peloponnesian War in outer space. And most people are, you know, aren't too familiar with Greek history. But one thing we all know, if I tell you this, the Peloponnesian War ruined two of history's greatest democracies when the hot rhetoric of their politicians drug them into this ruinous war. And that ought to sound very familiar to everybody, especially after the last election. And so we're trying to play on these themes exactly where Nick started, that, you know, history repeats itself, that humans, you know, fail over and over again, even though they may be reaching for the stars.
There's an inescapability of our past, and likewise for our main character, Sam, an inescapability of her past, where she's forced into something that she's trying to run away from, and has no choice but to get drawn into this epic struggle.
Well, we asked for it, and you gave it to us. That sounds extremely interesting and very compelling, and especially I like when, you know, I hear you guys talk, you know, when you do the research and you kind of have that tapestry that you're putting in, and you're not just, you know, throwing up a story that just makes it all the more compelling for me as a reader when I can get a feeling that the people who are, you know, putting this together actually have this kind of motive and context behind the story. Good job on the pitch. You know, for me, I'm sold.
Thank you.
Yeah, we try to be technically right. I carry from it my dad's voice in my head. My dad is a famous astronomer, and I remember vividly watching Star Wars with him and watching the famous scene where Han Solo is bragging how the Millennium Falcon can do a Kessel run in a certain number of parsecs. And I remember him just kind of throwing his hands up and said, "Dad, what's wrong?" And he said, "It's a unit of distance, not time." I remember saying to him, "You know, Dad, it's a movie." He said, "Yes, but they can afford to get the science right."
Yeah.
So I think we try to do that whenever we can. There's, you know, it's important to be as based in what could plausibly happen as possible. Some liberties, of course, because it's, you know, it's fiction at the same time, but we really want to get that right.
Yeah. Well, that Kessel run less than, you know, it was 5 or 12 parsecs, but that bothered me too, and I was only in high school, but I knew what a parsec was. So. He wasn't the only one. Yeah.
Yeah.
As he was just being a braggart and, you know, didn't know what he was talking about, and he did that on purpose, but I kind of have the feeling that Lucas didn't know what the hell he was talking about when he wrote that, so.
That's what comes across. I think they try to change it so that it's a race where you go a certain amount of distance instead of a certain amount of time, but
yeah.
It doesn't sound right to me.
Anyway, tell us a little bit about your impressions of the art. I'm assuming that you've seen some of the art already in the book.
We've been very closely involved in the art direction. My day job is running a video game studio in Seattle called Zombie Studios. And so the art direction on the mech suits and the walkers in particular, very critical to me. Really wanted to put a fine point on it because I'm a big fan of mecha fiction and mecha art. And we worked hard again when we started with Sid to do something unique rather than the kind of stamped out metal giant robot thing that you see everywhere. I was very much more influenced by like Sumishiro's Appleseed and that kind of look, Ghost in the Shell, Intron Depot. And when Nick brought Sid in and we asked him to do all this, we talked about what he wanted. The first concept we got just completely blew me away because it was completely original. I've never seen anything like it. They were highly organic, asymmetrical. They looked almost crustacean, you know, in their design grammar. And I was immediately excited by that. And when we finished the script and were then looking for artists and settled on Imaginary Friends Studio out of Singapore, we found exactly the right artist and colors for this book. And not only that, they did something also kind of unexpected. They, you know, when you love science fiction, you know, part of your imagination is to want to see the details of that world. Like, I want to really, you know and feel it. And so science fiction art tends to be very dense, you know. The best of it tends to try to reveal, you know, how things work and what everything's made out of in visual detail. But instead, Kai at Imaginary gave us this loose, emotional, very colorful.
Dreamlike, I think.
Yeah, and again, it was just amazing, surprising, and just so dead on from the very beginning. And so we just let him run with it after that. After I had given him all the concept stuff that we had done, he came back with something so much better. And I'm really happy about that. With when I show colleagues early galleys from the book, they're really surprised, you know, by what they're seeing because it's not the typical science fiction art at all. And I think it only serves to emotionally underscore the story that we're trying to tell. So instead of geeking out on kind of the science fiction details of spaceships and mech suits, we get a much more, I'll keep using this word, emotional resonance that ties back to our characters and kind of the epic story arc that we're putting them on.
It has a surprising power. It really sneaks up on you, and I couldn't be more thrilled with it.
Oh, it sounds really good. And, you know, I've seen on a lot of the other Radical books the art that comes out of Imaginary Friends Studios, and for the most part, it's been extremely good art, and I've been really happy with what they've got going on. So hearing you guys, you know, hey, have you seen it? And you know, you think it's really good. I've seen some preview art for it. There was a little, preview comic that I saw for Shrapnel. And, you know, same thing. There was no words in it, but it had the art samples and it looked very nice.
Oh, the entire series is like that.
Yeah, and, that's good.
Radical, you know, again, I couldn't be happier with our final partner in Radical Comics. First of all, they're releasing the first book as a double issue. It's 48 pages. It has four variant covers, and they're selling it for $1.99. Like, as a fan and a reader, you couldn't, you know, do more for me than that. And I just happened to see the, I think you did too, Nick, right? I sent you the first lettered version of the book that we've seen and got a chance to read it, and, you know, in its final form. And it's just really, really great. We couldn't be happier. And Radical
together like that is so great. Radical has been fantastic, and it's just gorgeous from beginning to end.
Yeah, and Radical, they've agreed to publish our entire trilogy. So it's, what, 15 books, and it will be 15 books, and the first issue of the second and third series will be double issues as well, they tell me. And,
oh, excellent.
You know, you can tell we're passionate about this project, and when you find somebody that, you know, not only shares your passion, but kind of really fundamentally gets it and wants to help you make it as successful as possible, it's just great, because these things take forever. I mean, Nick and I had this idea originally over 12 years ago, and it took 3 years from start of the first series to today. So it's immensely satisfying to get a partner, a publishing partner, that is going to take all this hard work and passion that we put into it and make sure it's successful.
Yeah, and for any of our listeners who go through discount comic book service like John and I do, this Shrapnel number one was one of our picks for November special discount, and Cameron has this at 45% off, so you can get this 48-page first issue for $1.09. And in my opinion, any DCVS customer that does not buy this number one issue is a crazy person. $1.09 for 48 pages, especially given how it looks, you know, try it out. And if you're not a DCBS customer and you have your local comic shop, that's great too. $1.99, that is an excellent price for a 48-page first issue. Go to your local comic shop owner and tell them you want a copy of this thing so that they order enough so that you'll be able to go in and buy it, because I can almost guarantee you that – you know, if your comic shop owner, you know, only orders, you know, 5 or 10 copies of this, if you're not in there in the first 2 hours on Wednesday when it comes out, if it's not on your pull list, it's going to be gone. People see this for $1.99, they're going to pick it up. So ask your comic shop owner, get it on your pull list, make sure he orders copies of it. Anything else you guys have to say about it? I think, you know, very compelling story that you tell here. Like I said, I'm sold on it, and I'll be getting it, but just want to make sure that all our listeners...
I'd like to, Nick, you know, it was Nick's idea that our hero be a woman.
Yeah.
And I'd like Nick to talk a little bit about Sam, I think, and about that choice, too.
Well, I've always been really fascinated by women in the military who are able to, you know, triumph over the gender stereotype. She's a really tough character, and yet also a very soulful one. I think we talked a lot about Joan of Arc as a kind of a modeling character, but also we talked about, I think, Tomoe Gozen of Japan and Boadicea. And, you know, these are exceptional people. I remember meeting women fighter pilots for another project a long time ago to sort of find out, you know, what made them tick and the kind of exceptionalism that it takes to succeed the way they have. And we try to build that character in our character Sam, who's you know, just a really great character to write, really fun and tough, and also a tragic heroine in her own right. So really, really a joy to be able to write this character, and I hope that the enthusiasm that we have for this shines through and people pick it up and give it a shot.
I absolutely think that your enthusiasm, as well as the way you've described this, does indeed shine through. And like I said, this seems to be a really nice package to introduce someone to this world. And I really encourage our listeners to give this one a try.
Yeah, and I also like the fact that Radical is committed to doing not only this complete series, but the other two. So we've got a reassurance that we're going to get the full story that you guys have laid out.
Yeah, that was very generous on their part, because we're both, Nick and I, first time to comics. And they, you know, it's, I think, in response to the story, just like you were saying, it's very compelling.
Definitely sounds really cool and something I'm looking forward to reading, too.
I was going to say, Mark, you know, Mark's background is more games, and mine's more movies and television. But, you know, Radical has been so great at helping us, you know, tell the story in the right medium. And, Jim DeMonakis has been fantastic, and, really feel grateful to be able to collaborate with people who know what they're doing as well as Radical. It's been top notch.
Yeah, one thing I want to stress is that even though Nick comes from the feature side as a screenplay writer and as a novel author, and I come at it as a video game designer, we really want this to be seen as a comic book first. Yeah. One of the things that I love, just really, truly love about the comic industry, when I get to Comic-Con and you see the deeper exchange between fans and authors and artists, it's just completely different from what I'm used to, where I will labor for 2 years or more on a title, and after all that blood, sweat, and tears, it goes out into the world and, you know, has the shelf life of like milk. It's gone. It's come and gone before you know it, and the only real feedback we get are from reviewers. It's just, it's deeply satisfying media to work in that regard, and so I sensed that immediately when we started on the book, and I wanted to make sure that we had that orientation, that we weren't trying to make a book that was going to get made into a movie or a game. We were going to make a great book first.
I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, that's a common criticism I see leveled against Radical Comics and also things from Boom Studios and some other of the publishers. And my standard response to that is, you know, you can have a good comic, and just because that subsequently is a really compelling, good story that gets turned into a movie, that doesn't, or a TV property or whatever, that doesn't degrade from the fact that it was a good comic book. Because in point of fact, if you put out a comic book that's a crap comic book, that is not going to compel a movie studio to want to turn it into a movie. You know, it's almost like, well, gee, even if you wanted to turn it into something, you would make it like the damn best comic book you could, you know, which to me, that's a win-win. You know, I like reading a good comic book. And, you know, if that gets turned into some other kind of a property down the line, I have no problem with that either. You know, I like all the different kinds of media, but I really appreciate it when you point out that you really want to see this be a good quality comic book.
You know, we care too much about it, and I think it's the perfect medium for what we want to do. There's a lot of freedom in it, and yet it's structured in a way that it gives us the real feeling of the epic arc we want to take it in. And I love the collaborative quality of it. You know, you write for TV or movies, and people take what you do, and then you sort of see it later. But here we're getting, you know, interaction with the art as it's happening, with incredibly talented artists, and to be able to shape it the way we want is just a real joy.
There's something else, you know, as a game designer that I learned in this process, and that is great about comics, that it only comics have, and that was at one point we were working on a scene, and I think Nick and Zach were fighting for, you know, a bigger scene, you know, more spaceships or something like that. And something in me was resisting that, and it was the game designer in me where I'm thinking, always worried about how are we going to do that. You know, that sounds like a great idea, but dude, that sounds expensive, or it'll take forever, or it's technically too hard. And I think it was Zach said, Mark, it's a comic. You can just draw a picture of it. You can literally do whatever you want. And believe it or not, that was an epiphany to me. And so I found the rest of the process really liberating, because, you know, it's literally that. That's the real genius, I think, about comics is it can be literally anything, because I don't know, there is an army of people that have to act it out or produce it as a CG movie. It's a, you know, a single writer and artist and colorist, that kind of thing.
Yeah, as long as it can be drawn, we can do it.
Yeah.
So no inverted negative space tesseracts or anything like that.
Well, now that you mention this. No, I mean, it's really fun. And the in movies too, you have to, as a screenwriter, you have to be very cautious about what you put in so you don't break the bank on things. As a novel writer, of course, you have a lot more freedom. And this is sort of a really, it has a fun structure of almost a television kind of structure, but the freedom of novel writing. And I'm just thrilled to be able to do it. Big comic fan for a long, long time, so being able to step into this water is really a lot of fun.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I'd like to thank you both for taking the time with us to talk about the story and talk about this comic, and we're really looking forward to it.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks a lot.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.